any part of the body which you so desire. The moment the concentration is removed, the symbol dies out. This actually must mean, therefore, that we are in direct control of the body at all times, and probably almost all of its processes. The only possible exception being the actual function of the heart. This we can influence, but it is not certain whether we can completely control it. If this thinking be logical, we have at our disposal certain immediate therapeutic uses of suggestion once the formulas, techniques, and methodology are clearly developed. We have the power through concentration or through a kind of hypnotic intensification of self-suggestion. We have the power to break up blockages in circulation. We have the power to restore impaired function if it has not gone too far. We have the power to hasten elimination of toxins from various areas of the body. We have a power to create so rapid a circulation that we can prevent blood poisoning. We also have the power to block circulation to the degree that we can prevent some dangerous element from circulating quickly throughout the system. We have power to hasten the rapidity of cure for various ailments, including broken bones. We have the power to adjust ourselves to changes of temperature, to various pressures, to intensify physical strength within a reasonable degree. This we realize the moment we recognize also that in cases of certain mental disease, the strength of a comparatively healthy person, a comparatively weak person, suddenly becomes excessive. And a person who in normal life has practically no strength may require several persons to restrain them if once the mental equilibrium is lost. This also means that this additional strength is always available without mental unbalance. So out of the study of this different type of research, we realize that it is possible to combat fatigue, that it is possible to hasten many processes and thus accomplish a more rapid recovery from sickness. All of these points, of course, leave us on the horns of another dilemma. Suggestion is only about as important as the intelligence of the suggesting power, whatever it may be. If the operator, in the case of hypnosis, makes a wrong suggestion which is still not contrary to some innate reservation on the part of the subject, the result may not be good. The individual, believing that he knows what he wants or he needs, trying to suggest to himself, may only block necessary symptoms and hide from himself ailments which might, through neglect, become serious or even mortal. Therefore, suggestion, like the aspirin tablet, is dangerous in the hands of the person who uses it without judgment or excessively. Things that help wisely used hinder if unwisely used. We need, therefore, a very clear vision of structure and function in order to know how it should be influenced to produce the necessary and proper results. Here is a whole world that has not been touched. We are perfectly content to assume that the suggestion is right if it achieves the end that we immediately recognize to be necessary. But nature has a very involved way of working. And nearly always, trouble is nature's effort to remedy a greater trouble. Thus, if we block nature's means, for example, of disposing of poison in the system, or if we cause it to be eliminated more rapidly than nature intended, we may get into further trouble. Thus, the accurate knowledge of nature's own way is essential to the best use of suggestion in all of its fields. Without this use, there are many sad consequences. The use of hypnosis as a means of psychotherapy also presents a wide new world of special possibilities. Certain ailments traditionally resist hypnotic treatment. These ailments are, for the most part, ailments which do not arise within the area of the therapy, or against which the therapy is incorrectly directed. For example, take alcoholism. A person seeking hypnotic help for this ailment is likely to ask that the desire for alcohol be blocked, on the assumption that if it is blocked, that the habit will be broken. Actually, this is not usually true. Under some conditions, alcoholism is successfully treated by suggestion. But as in all forms of medicine and in all forms of therapy, the results are not standardized. That is why we actually refer to medicine as an art rather than a science. It's because we are not able to standardize the results of treatment. We have a wide explanation for this, developing primarily from the utter individuality of the construction of each individual. We are all different. Therefore, because of innumerable factors of difference, we will not react in the same way to various medications. There is more to it than difference. And the case of the use of hypnosis for alcoholism is at point. Alcoholism is itself only a symptom. Very few persons actually drink because they enjoy the taste of alcohol. They do so because, perhaps, of social pressure, but to become truly alcoholic because of psychic pressure. This psychic pressure means that there is something within the psychic compound itself which is out of order, which is not adequately sustaining the integrity of the individual. He is suffering from psychic stress. He is suffering from worry, from fear, from perpetual adolescence, from any one of a number of ailments. And the alcoholism is merely the breakthrough of these symptoms. Therefore, to use hypnosis to correct it by directing the hypnotic suggestion in the form of I do not want alcohol, may be saying no more than the individual himself has already said to himself 1,000 times. The blocking of this outlet is possible temporarily, but very temporarily, because the pressure behind has not been touched. The real situation has not been reached. Hypnosis, then, as merely a sedation of some kind, as merely a temporary liberation from a group of symptoms, supplies only a very small part of its contribution. The larger contribution lies in the digging in to the various elements of the situation. Let us take the first series of possible examples. Under hypnotic pressure, or under hypnotic influence, children have been taught to read and write, who were otherwise very slow in this ability, or these abilities. The child has been assisted to keep up with its studies. Spelling has been improved. Memory has been improved. Coordination has been helped. And the ability to, we'll say, arrange patterns of study have been stimulated. Thus we see that hypnosis can suggest things to do that need doing. If the person does these things, he himself naturally benefits from the doing. Here we have a kind of habit mechanism which can have considerable results. Although, again, we may have to search behind to find out why the child is slow of learning. Sometimes it is poor instruction. Sometimes it is comparative indifference to the subject. Oftentimes it is psychic stress. All of these elements can be weighed and examined. And by so doing, the facts can become known and worked with. In psychoanalysis, a great problem arises in the isolation of the true cause of a very serious neurotic pressure, frustration, or tension. Usually, the individual has gone through either one intense stress pattern or a series of less intense ones, which work together to set up a mechanism in that area. Very often, this stress pattern and the circumstance are not consciously remembered. Therefore, we have the outlet of dreams. Dreams have a certain relationship to psychic or to hypnotic procedure. Just as the hypnotized person is not merely allowed to sleep, but is subjected to certain conditioning so that he is able to serve himself during sleep, or to unfold certain aspects of his nature while unconscious of what he is doing. So in a measure, dreams are a reversal of this procedure. For in dreams, interior pressures push forward into the objective. And powerful dreams can become, in their own turn, suggestion or hypnotic pressure. Many persons have been hypnotized by a dream and have therefore come under a very strong influence which may have a serious effect upon them. One of the reasons why dreams may come true is because subconsciously we are making them come true. We are determined in some way to fulfill them, or are so strongly influenced by them that this fulfillment becomes an instinctive process in ourselves. Now in hypnosis, we recognize three distinct levels of influence. We have what may be termed light hypnotic tension. In this state, the individual is able to accept certain suggestions. He is aware that he accepts these suggestions. But he is also aware that his resistance to suggestion has been lowered. He is in a sympathy with the suggestion. He is in a state in which his own attitudes do not rise belligerently against the suggestion. If you say to an individual in his conscious state, you can control your temper, he will explain to you at great length why he cannot. Why it wouldn't be fair for him to if he could. And that the whole problem lies in the fact that other people badly treat him. Under hypnotic tension, even under light hypnosis, the individual simply forgets all of these secondary considerations. They simply cease to exist. He has only a complete receptivity. If the operator tells him that he can overcome a bad disposition, Chap says, well, I guess I can. It never occurs to him any longer to say, no, I can't. This objection function has been blocked. And this would be a happy world indeed if more objection functions were continuously blocked. But not really, because these in turn have to be explored. But lots of folks would be happier now and immediately if there were less objectors in the world. The second degree of hypnosis involves a further intensification of it. The subject loses orientation with things around him. If in the midst of treatment the doorbell rings, he will not be disturbed, whereas in light hypnosis he probably will be. If things occur which might, under some situations, draw him back again into his own consciousness, these occurrences will not have this effect if he has reached a middle or moderate degree of hypnotic tension. He is sort of alone now in space. No one around but the operator. He is conscious. He knows that he is being given suggestions. He hears the words. And he accepts them without resistance. When he later is brought out of the hypnotic state, he will remember everything that occurred. He will remember the words just as he would remember them in the lightest or first degree of hypnosis. So the first degree and second degree have this point in common, that the entire procedure is consciously remembered afterwards. In many ways, the light or moderate hypnosis has therapeutic advantages. It helps the person to have confidence in the operator. The person knows how he is being suggested. He knows what is happening. No suggestion can be slipped over on him. He is not afraid that he will be told to do something which will be contrary to some basic principle or conviction or belief that he has. On the other hand, because he is still self-conscious, the degree of penetration of suggestion is not as great as it is in the third degree, or, for practical purposes, the deep hypnotic trance. In this condition, the patient is no longer consciously aware of himself, nor of the operator, nor of any circumstance occurring around him. Yet in this condition, he may and often does develop an independent awareness, which may again be somewhat likened to sleep awareness. The patient, for example, or the subject, under deep hypnosis, with no conscious memory of himself or of the operator, can develop a living personality of his own, which exists only during hypnosis, as sometimes it occurs only during sleep. Regression also shows that the person in this condition can move back to his own life experience, identifying himself only with the immediate occurrences. In this state, memory is blocked. And the blocking of memory is very interesting. For memory is not only the remembering of the past, but the remembering of environment and the familiar now. Therefore, the blocking of memory places the individual entirely outside of the time sequence factor. His experience consists of a sequence of independent frames, like the single frames of a motion picture film. He moves from frame to frame, and the one he is in exists. The one he moves from has no existence. The one he moves to is not anticipated. This timelessness, which is part of your deep hypnosis factor, has even religious and spiritual implications. By means of it, man is able to actually pass through a series of immediate experiences of now. But the being which experiences this now does not record the experience. Here we have perhaps a key to certain mystical experiences of individuals who do on occasion break through the time-place barriers and come into immediate contact with eternal situations. It is quite possible that the study of this field of immediacy in third-degree hypnosis will have validity in both the scientific and philosophical world in years to come. The person having now developed an independent existence may and can live in this existence in a reasonably complete manner. A person under third degree hypnosis does not have to lie on a couch like a block of marble, and certainly does not need to be suspended across two chair backs as was fashionable in the 19th century. Actually, this person can get up, engage in conversation, have a very vivacious and animated time, mix with people, shake hands with them, know them, discuss all kinds of problems with them. And yet this person will not exist or be remembered in any way when the subject is actually brought out of hypnosis. More of special value through regression is that this person can be regressed into elaborate pageants of situations. A case in which a young man in his 20s led a complete symphony orchestra might be at point. In his 50s, under psychological treatment, he was regressed to that great concert in which he was the conductor. For several hours, in fact, the full length of the concert, he stood upon an imaginary podium, waved a non-existing baton, and conducted an orchestra, even going so far as to hum with the music, which is an old conductor's trick. He heard this music exactly. He knew exactly the bar that was being played at any time. He also realized about halfway through the concert that the first violinist was a little flat. This caused him no end of anguish. He received the applause of a vast, non-existing audience with proper dignity, humility, and exaltation. He lived the whole thing. He was in every way completely re-experienced something long ago. Every sensibility had this awareness. Now, supposing we say that this same person was then returned again to a comparatively calm, sleepless state, and later awakened with the suggestion not to remember. Under such conditions, he would have no recording in his conscious mind at all that he had experienced or lived through again this symptom. What does this tell us? It tells us that this experience which he relived was always present in him. It was not manufactured out of thin air. It was merely given a means of expression. He was living with that symphony continuously, day and night, in himself. It had never ceased. If it had ever ceased, even for a moment, he could not restore it. This gives us a new dimension of memory. It proves to us that memory is not merely the record of the past, but contains within its dimensions the power to re-experience the past. And one point we have often made of memory is the blessed fact that we can remember, but we cannot re-experience, which has been our common theory. The only reason we cannot re-experience is because we permit our memory to fall under the time-place sequence of suggestion and outlaw the possibility of immediate reconstruction of the emotional impact and experience of an event. This tells us that in our memory, therefore, is the power, if we know how to use it, to relive everything that has ever happened to us. Nature does not wish us to relive these experiences. Therefore, has placed a blessed silence on this faculty within our own nature. Yet nature itself occasionally calls upon such things. And here is an interesting point in hypnotic control again. The operator placing the person in this space and inviting the person to re-experience this wonderful concert, or whatever it may have been. The operator wasn't present at the concert. No part of this suggestion came from the operator. He was not forcing the man to relive an experience. To do so, he would have had to impart that experience either in words, or in thoughts, or in attitudes, or in some symbol that would stimulate it. This was not necessary. Therefore, the operator did not create the concert in the person's mind. The operator only made possible the release of this situation that already existed. Here is one further evidence that it is not right or fair to say that the operator forces experiences upon the individual. He frequently permits the individual to experience circumstances of which the operator has no knowledge at all. The same is true in your regression technique. The operator regressing a subject for psychological purposes has no idea what he is going to find. Therefore, he cannot suggest it. Yet if he works upon the patient objectively, he can suggest We can suggest things sometimes more strongly in a conscious state than we can when the subject is under hypnotic tension. If a person coming to an analyst or psychologist explains his situation and the psychologist says to him, well, I'll bet that's the result of that difficulty you had in boarding school, the patient, seizing on anything, will say, oh, yes, undoubtedly. Now I remember it clearly. He is immediately fulfilling the analyst's desire. He is also leading himself into a suggestion that it has been planted, therefore can very well be wrong. But if the analyst, regressing that person to that experience in boarding school, carries the person through it, causing him to relive it, he may find that nothing of real importance actually occurred at all. Everyone was wrong. It would come out finally in analysis, but finally may be quite a long time from now. Therefore, the analyst or the hypnotic analyst goes further. He moves the individual back and forth over time span. There may be a dozen possible or probable critical situations that have been brought out by ordinary discussion. The analyst drops the consciousness of the person under tension into each one of these situations. And suddenly, in the midst of one of them, the patient passes into the mood of the original occurrence. He suffers. He screams. He groans. He is hurt. He is offended. The bottom has dropped out of his world. May have been some little thing that the analyst would never normally have looked for. It was that day his parents took the rabbit away from him. It was that day when some illusion, some dream was destroyed. There we begin to get down to the basis of the matter. Also, we have no way of measuring, under normal conditions, the nature and detail of this reaction except through the long, confused, consequential meanderings of this reaction through circumstances. By the time an individual has lived with a reaction for 20 years, mixed it into every project of his life, been hurt by it in a dozen different ways, and has been modified in character until perhaps very little of his original nature is any longer apparent, this person has trouble in trying to clearly isolate the real facts about his own problem. But under this type of hypnotic tension, he can tell exactly what caused the trouble. The operator can find out the peculiar psychic twist of that person's childish personality that made this thing hurt him so profoundly. Why it hurt him, how it hurt him, what he did about it. All these things are relived, and the intensity of the reliving reveals the intensity of the psychic pressure. Sometimes several things have combined to create this pressure, but in almost every instance, reliving of it can bring it out. This reliving under this type of pressure is released directly, coherently. It is released in a manner in which it can be quickly used and can perhaps suggest certain psychotherapeutic counter-suggestions or compensatory suggestions which will help. On the other hand, this reliving of the true experience is not limited actually at all to the hypnotic state. It is there all the time, like the concert. And where the pressure gets too great, it may break through in dream symbolism, without the use of hypnotic suggestion. But when it breaks through in this way, it breaks through symbolically. It breaks through association or by means of some design, figure, symbol, or device, by a theatrical dramatization of the event with a new cast of characters. It is not brought forth in its original nature. As a result of this difference, it is less available for immediate use. It can be interpreted gradually, but we must plow our way through all possible explanations, perhaps, before we are able to pick the correct one. When an individual has a dream indicating that he has been over-influenced, this is not as helpful as might at first appear. For the probabilities of being over-influenced are universal. And the probabilities that any one individual has been over-influenced is not a probability of one such occurrence, but the almost certainty that he has been over-influenced many times. Which one has caused the damage? It is not even always the first one. It is the one which created a peculiar stress in that person. So now, through hypnosis, we get into a peculiar realization that there is a strata of human consciousness, a stratum of life, in which everything is continuously experienced. And this continuous experience, even in the struggle to clear it hypnotically, is interesting on a dimensional basis. A person, for instance, can relive one situation and then be progressed to another, and so on, or regressed backwards. And these experiences are only in this frame-like structure because the operator is moving that way. He is moving from one guidepost to another. He does not know what lies between. He can, theoretically, if he wishes to live long enough at it, complete an entire recapitulation of the entire life of the individual. He can take its waking and sleeping phenomena, and he can cause this person to go through the past 30 years exactly as they happened. Every move, every instinct, every thought, every reflex, but it will take 30 years because he has to relive the whole thing over again. Yet any moment of that 30 years can be pulled out. If it is dropped back, another moment can be pulled out. Also, the flowing of events will indicate that they can be moved backward and forward at will, and all that is required is a focal point. Thus, out of this mystery can be redrawn or recaptured at any moment, any part of it, simply by focalizing on it. This opens a tremendous field of speculation concerning the interior constitution of the human psyche. It gives us much more to think about and work upon than we have ever suspected before. Under the same general theme of hypnosis, we move towards what might be termed the future, the development of the techniques of this subject as they may apply. We know, for example, that in the life of the person today, most of his basic problems are unsolved. He is helped, he is hindered. But always he is inadequate because he does not have conscious control of his own unconscious impulses. He does not know the real reason for the things he does. He does not know why his attitudes break into patterns which sometimes persecute him. He does not know any cause for his likes or dislikes, except perhaps very superficial and secondary reactions to inadequate stimuli. He does not know why he is what he is. He also does not know how he can be what he ought to be. The only way in which the final solution can come is the opening up of the entire interior life of man. The realization that the internal moves the external. That everything that happens to us on the outside of life is the result of pressures from the inside of life. Also, we suspect strongly that what we call the extrasensory perception gamut can also be stimulated by hypnotic suggestion. It is quite conceivable that under hypnosis, the individual can be clairvoyant. It is very possible that under hypnosis, the individual can discover laws and rules of the greatest value to his own conduct, to the advancement of science and knowledge, and to the final solution of world problems. He can discover anything that is locked within himself. Also, he can be assisted to stimulate the faculties of discovery. It not only is that discovery represents a kind of mind. It represents an attitude toward phenomena. Some people are geniuses. We do not know why, except to assume that by philosophic merit they have attained this rank. We do not know how far sensory perception can be intensified. We know it is being intensified slowly all the time. Is this slow growth of intensification its proper pace? If it is its proper pace, then we have no right to interfere with it, because our inward perception must be sustained by the total asset of our personality and consciousness. If, however, we are lagging behind in extrasensory perception merely because we have become too psychologically sick to grow properly, if nature is being delayed and frustrated in its natural development of faculties which it intends us to have, then various forms of suggestion therapy can be used to break through, not only to break through this restriction, but by analysis to discover the reason for this restriction in our own case and correct it. Thus, it is quite conceivable that certain things can be done better. Well, hypnosis will not take a person who cannot play an instrument and make virtuosity. But it can set an individual down to a piano who has never been there before, cause that person to drum violently on the piano the most horrible discords, and hear these discords as the most heavenly music. His music may satisfy no one but himself, but for himself it is most satisfactory. But if this person has once been trained in music, the power can be revitalized and restored. Techniques can be devised. They're not too rapid, but they can be set up, by which a lost skill can be regained more rapidly than by normal procedures. The lost skill is therefore merely a lost coordination. This can be corrected. Also, a person in whose life good things have been retarded by some peculiar nervous mechanism. Some an example of nervous mechanism that is uncomfortable is the old-fashioned tic, or stuttering, or stammering. Many times, these will respond to adequate psychotherapy. And frequently, they will respond rather quickly to second-degree hypnosis. Why? Because the person hears himself speaking correctly and remembers it, and therefore is relieved of the fear that his trouble is structural or that no remedy is possible. On the other hand, hypnosis cannot restore that which has been totally lost by disease or sickness or by accident. It can, however, act in many ways to assist the person to regain control over himself. Suggestion is always most effective when the person receiving it is receptive. Thus, in all things in life in which leadership by ourselves, over ourselves, is necessary, the attainment of this depends upon an attitude of receptivity within our own nature. If we are not able to relax our objective tension, we block the leadership of our own consciousness over our body. This we learn from hypnotic theory. And we also, therefore, recognize that whenever we desire to make a real or vital improvement in ourselves, or to make a conscious dedication to principles that are real and valid, that we should first of all place ourselves in a properly receptive relationship with life. That we must be quiet. We must be still. We must permit that which is good in us to move from the conscious mind into the subconscious without blocking it by our own arguments. The dignity of great truths contributes to their acceptance because we are less likely to block them. This is why religious instruction is valuable. We accept things that we believe without argument. And in this way, they can become more directly and immediately effective in our lives. The case as it unfolds is almost endless. But out of it all comes the realization that hypnotic research will undoubtedly tell us a lot more than we know now about the causal structure behind our personal existence. And through becoming more intimately aware of this, we can cooperate with it better. And by discovering more of the dimensions of the subjective universe in which we live, we can orient ourselves more effectively. Thus, we do believe that as time passes, research in this area can be both practical and beneficial, and will advance both theoretical and practical knowledge.